Family and I are happy to be back. It's kind of pleasant to be back in town, sitting in your own home after we had one Sabbath at Dubois with the birds and everyone prior to camp, and a Sabbath in camp, and a Sabbath at Great Falls with the congregation of Helena and Great Falls together. So we've been able to church hop a little bit as we were out. It was it's always interesting just to see a different group in a different place. We'd like to say hello to Kennewick and Lewiston. When we were in Great Falls, Dan Deininger got up and said, "Well, I'd like to introduce your new pastor." Well, I'm the old pastor, but I'm the new pastor, because in the United News it said they were changing the circuit. And so people got the impression that that was actually going to happen. And the reality is that the Romers, if you've read your United News, can't possibly be in place until at least November. And that means probably effectively somewhere close to first of the year before any fundamental change can take place. So just for what it's worth, we're all in this together the same as we've always been. And so we'll have a good time for another 6 months, I suppose. And then some of the transition will take place and the circuit will be reconfigured at that point. It's nice to come back and have Frank up here stealing my scriptures and my conclusion. But it is it's reassuring to me that I guess I must have been hopefully on the right track. Surely we both were not on the wrong track. I mean, when you come up with the same focus, it's always encouraging to me to believe God knows His people. He knows what's on the minds of His people and their needs. And He directs those of us who teach, if we strive to submit ourselves to Him, to teach according to His will. And it's an element of faith to understand and believe that, but it's a remarkable thing to see it play out. A few have asked as we came in the door if I was up on the Grand again. We did go back up on the Grand. I will say this year appears to be the year of the approach as compared to the year of the standing on top of anything. We were 700 feet from the top, and it rained, and then it hailed, and we sat there huddled under a rock waiting for just the final approach. There was just 700 feet left, and we were sitting there and having a good time, climbing well, just excellent. This was a wet year in the Tetons, and basically it rained every day. And so depending on what time it was, you know, rained at night or in the afternoon or in the morning, and just depending on where you were was where the cloud was. And we were sitting there 700 feet to go, and it rained and the clouds blew through, and then we waited a bit, and then it cleared off and the sun came out and it dried, and we started up and it rained and hailed, and then the clouds moved in. At one point you couldn't see anything, the cloud just socked in, and we were just sitting there on the rock kind of waiting for a break. And finally, a big, ugly black cloud came over, and since we had been up there the year before, and it wasn't as much fun as we thought it would be when that cloud moved in, we decided to hightail it off the top, and we got down about 40 minutes, and the weather broke, and it cleared up, and it was beautiful. But it was too late. We had used our window of time, but we had an excellent time. We were up on the mountain. We were close. Like I said, this year is the year of the approach. There's different lessons to learn in all things. As we came back, in fact, as we turned on the news this afternoon at noon coming to church, had mentioned the fires in Wilson. Wilson, Michelle has a friend whose grandfather is Mr. Wilson, whatever his first name was. And the town there, right outside of Jackson, just a couple of miles, is where he had lived. He lived with the Indians and homesteaded the property and established the town site, and it's named after him. And so we went over to Wilson to see the statue and to see who he was, because her friend had asked us to, and stopped there in that area because it was so close. And it's interesting coming back to hear that there's 1,000 firefighters on duty fighting a fire right on the outskirts of Wilson there. And so it's not affecting anyone in the town at this point, but it is burning in that area, which is considerably south of where the Challenger camp is actually established. Challenger camp this year, we started, I think, with 64 campers. We finished with 64. We didn't lose any. But that's, I had to be careful how I worded that. We had 40 staff, and we have a very high staff-to-camper ratio at the Challenger camp because of the types of activities we do. David Hurst was there as a camper, and Christina was there as staff. And I think they won't be coming in now till probably Monday because they're, I think, at the Choteau camp out in Montana at this point. But it was excellent. As I said, it basically rained every day. We had Sabbath services and the sun was out. And we finished Sabbath services and took a quick picture of the whole group, and then it just absolutely poured. And we were all huddled under the tarps and tent where the cook line is in the kitchen, have an area to cook that's under tarps. And so we were able to basically have our activities, but we were darting and dodging the rain at all times. We have question and answer every evening where the campers ask us questions and we ask them questions. And we had split up one evening, the boys and the girls, into two groups so that we could talk separately to them. And the girls took the tarps and the guys took the open fire and the rain. And we literally sat outside in a question and answer with a big group of the teens and some of the staff there. And it's kind of dripping, drizzling, spitting rain as we sat there. And we literally didn't move. We made it through the whole session. It never poured, I will say that. But just being there this year was a bit of a challenge. Paul Lukey opening night said that the program was designed to challenge them. What he didn't tell them is that God had contributed to that by constantly chasing us around in the rain. We were dodging the rain and rock climbing, but it was amazing. God allowed us to have our activities. There was one morning when we had a little bit late out of camp because we had a new class, so we had to outfit them with harnesses and get them their gear and fit them, and then we had to go. We rented rock shoes this year, and with the rock shoes, the campers were able to make better climbs and be more efficient when they were climbing. And so we actually spent the morning going down to Moose, which is a little town, and renting the shoes. And while we were at Moose, it just literally poured. It just was torrents of rain, clouds, lightning crashing, and we're renting gear to go climb on the rocks. Well, you don't climb anything when it's wet at all. But by the time we got all of our gear sorted, got the shoes rented, got in the cars, got stopped at this entrance to the park as they were checking all of our gear and our passes, and another half hour walk up, by the time we got to the rocks, they were bone dry, and we climbed the rest of the day. So even when we were delayed, it was like God said, all right, I got to get some rain in. I'm going to get it in right now. And by the time you get out there, don't worry, it's going to be all right. So I'm not aware of any activities that were canceled during the entire camp, but literally every single day. The final night, we were washed out from the campfire and had to take shelter under the cook tents again to do the closing ceremonies, present the awards, and closing comments. And so, but again, it was all able to be accomplished. Backpackers were out for 3 days, and they finished all of their trip back. The backpackers do a 10-mile hike as a warm-up to see who gets to go backpacking. And it's not 10 miles in a circle around the lake. It's 10 miles, 5 miles up the side of the Tetons, and then 5 miles back. I forget, there's probably 3,000 feet of elevation gain. And that's just the test to see who goes on the rest. So they're carrying some significant gear and making some mileage. The canoers were actually paddling on a river that some are using for whitewater rafting. And Mr. Horchek said, you know, it's really exciting when you come through and here's these families coming through on their rafts and you're coming through on your canoes right with them. And they just kind of look at you like, wow, you know. And I think on the first 2 days, all but Mr. Horchek had dumped, just going through with the staff. But by the time they had worked with everybody and then selected special campers, they all made it through on the final run. So there's a canyon section they were using. So it's a remarkable environment. so many rock climbers made certificate climbs. We have certain climbs rated with a technical climbing rating, and so many of the climbers with the shoes made those climbs that I almost ran out of certificates. And I usually carry enough for 2 or 3 years. And we were issuing them like toilet paper, I think, sometimes, yeah, out the door. But the campers are returning. They're improving their skills. They're actually picking up some of the sports on their own time during the year and coming back more proficient. They're bringing their own gear that they're buying and bringing them to camp. They have their own shoes. Some of them had their own belts and stuff and things. So we're just seeing a development of the program overall. It really was a very, very good year. Various youth camps in United have special activities to build teamwork and character under certain types of stress. Now, team sports have always done that to a degree. I mean, that's what coaches will tell you, football, basketball, baseball, in many respects, is all about. It's about building teamwork and character under certain types of stress. When you see the camp film every year, you'll see now ropes courses. And the camps that we rent in various places, the ropes courses have become very popular. And what you'll generally see is the high ropes, where somebody is jumping with a harness and a rope on, but jumping for the next piece of rope or gear or swinging across. McKenzie has had a ropes course down in Pine Crest, or is it, what's in California, the California camp? Oakhurst. Did not they have high ropes in Oakhurst? Or they had a number of camps, you see them in the film. Camp McKenzie this year had an extended program where they climbed one of the sisters after camp, and I heard very good reports on that. Now, did we have anybody who's here today that went on that? Okay, a couple of them, because I think Tyler was on it, I think, and Heather, I think, was on it as well. But anyway, they had a chance to do a climb, a hiking climb, and some of our teams went there and enjoyed it very much. Those types of programs develop various character traits. One of the most important traits, though, I believe they do develop is courage. And courage is something that we focus on at Challenger Camp. And I'd like to share a story with you that, frankly, if you were there, was more dramatic than I can tell it. But I'll try to stretch it a bit just to make up for the fact that you weren't able to see it firsthand. Christina Hurst was climbing on her second day with us, and I had no idea that she was afraid of heights. And I told this story at camp in illustration when I handed her a certificate and award for personal courage. I actually, it's the only certificate I've ever issued for that, because usually we have a climb, it's rated, you climb that climb, you get a certificate. But I issued her a certificate for personal courage. We have a climb on the second day at Blacktail Butte that's probably 50 feet, and it may be a little taller than that. It also includes offset on the rope, because you're climbing left and back and forth to the left and to the right as you go. And so there's times when you have a pendulum on that rope, and the pendulum might be out 12, 13 feet to one side. So if you fall off the rock, you swing across the face. And you have to push out with your feet so that you swing across and come back in and plant when you land. And it is a certain amount of risk. We teach the campers what to do at those points, and they have to be able to do it. The problem is, it's also a place, as you get up about halfway, where there are what we call no positive holds. When you open the door and you grab the knob, that's a positive hold. You can grab it with your hand and pull against it. You could hang on that if it was high enough and you were strong enough. Those are positive holds. Non-positive holds are what we call like slopers, where, if I can describe this to those congregations here listening, but it's where you have a downslope on the hold and you simply are holding on with a certain amount of friction. Some holds you just squeeze with your fingers. You can't grab or hook your hand or put any weight. You simply balance and squeeze your fingers. There are holds for your feet where, instead of standing on a ledge, we're doing what you call a smear, which means you have these sticky rubber climbing shoes that have soft soles, and the rocks are a little bit rough, and you just literally stick your sole on the rock where there's a little tiny bump or something, and it gives you a little bit of grip. Now, you can't stand on that foot, but you can put one hand on a squeeze, you can put both feet on smears, and another hand on something that's a sloper, and then you balance on all four, and you just kind of slide up, push up. You have to push evenly on all your hands and your feet. Now, you're on a rope, so it's not like you're going to hit the bottom if you drop. But if you, at the point on this climb, where you have to push up with these slopers and non-positive holds, happens to be the point where the rope is the furthest to the side. And so Christina was up there climbing, and again, I didn't know until she started up that she was afraid of heights. And I mean, deathly afraid of heights. And yet she was determined to go ahead and make this climb. She cried. She stuttered. She stopped and was going to quit 20 times. The climb probably took a half an hour as she fought her personal fear. She never quit. When she would say, I can't do this, and we'd say, you're doing fine, go on, she'd say, okay. She would, emotionally, you could just see her struggling to hold on to that fear. And every time she got stuck, we talked to her, and she says, okay. And she waited, and then she would go up through the next section of the climb. The section where there's no positive holds also gives you a feeling that the rock is pushing at you a little bit. It's just the way the rock is shaped. You're not unsafe, but the sensation is that the rock is giving you just a little bit of a shove, pushing you outside because of the way your balance is. You're just not leaning the way you'd like to lean. She worked to the top of that climb and screamed out in delight at the top. Came back down to the bottom and just broke out into sobbing tears standing there. It was incredible. I have never in my life seen somebody push through their fear that way. I've seen people quit. I've seen people fail. I've seen people that it wasn't a problem because they just simply had the skills or the ability or the comfort zone and just went up and finished and went on. But I have never seen somebody so afraid who refused to submit to their fear. It was remarkable. I said, I've never given an award in that respect like that. And I gave her an award for personal courage. The class that was watching cheered as she came down and held her and hugged her and encouraged her as she shook and cried when it was done. But it was a remarkable thing, and I just wish you could have seen it. It was an accomplishment beyond what many of us ever really try to do in pushing past our limits. Revelation 21 is an account. And I don't want to read much more than just a couple of verses here. In fact, parts of those. And God shows a character trait here that if we don't push past it, we won't be in the kingdom of God. Revelation 21, verse 7. He who overcomes shall inherit all things. He who overcomes. We have our part to play. God doesn't do it all for us. He'll say, go on, you're okay. He'll say, I'm with you. He'll give us strength, but we choose to go on. We choose to continue. He who overcomes shall inherit all things. I will be his God, and he shall be my son. And then it gives you some of the categories of people that simply aren't going to be in the kingdom, and we say, okay, fine, idolatry, murder, sexually immoral, unbelieving, without faith. You know, those are sensible things, but the very first one that is illustrated says the cowardly. The cowardly will not be in the kingdom of God. If we do not have personal courage, we will not be in the kingdom of God. That's a remarkable thing. That almost seems to be a little different. There are different kinds of courage, just as there are different kinds of fear. There is the bold and open courage that David had in facing Goliath. Those are the stories that we put in the newspapers and make documentaries about and tell to our children, is it not? Daniel in the lion's den, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, David and Goliath, Noah, Jonah, all of these dramatic stories. They're encouraging, they're inspiring, they're people that fight through their fears, in some cases forced to fight through their fears. And we tell those stories, and they're there for a lesson, a purpose as well. But there is also a quiet inner courage of conviction that we hold in our hearts, a very private courage, frankly, that is the kind of courage that we live day by day. It doesn't take courage to get out of bed and drive here to church, generally speaking. But it does take courage to keep the Sabbath overall. One kind of courage is not necessarily better than the other. I believe that we need them both to answer God's call. But again, it's the quiet inner courage that we actually use in living our lives day by day. I want to go first, and I want to look at the account of David and Goliath, because it is so dramatic, and sometimes we miss the way the approach to this battle took place. But in 1 Samuel 17, I want to read through this first. And once in a while, we will have this type of courage. The place we got stopped on the Grand Teton, we were using a different route this year than before. It's actually an easier route, but there's more exposure. And the place that we were stopped when we turned back, we were sitting there hanging from a crack, and it was 2,000 feet down below our feet. Now, it wasn't a difficult place to stand, and it wasn't a hard place to hang on, but it was just the realization that there's 2,000 feet of air below your feet. There's times when we do things that are more dramatic than others. Those are moments, if I added them up in my life, would probably not total much more than a couple of hours. All the rest of my life is spent in a totally different scale. 1 Samuel 17, starting in verse number 3, the Philistines stood on a mountain on one side, Israel stood on a mountain on the other, and there was a valley between them. And you know the story that Goliath is out here challenging the army of the Israelites. And a champion went out from camp of the Philistines named Goliath. And the reason I wanted to read this part is I wanted to translate, if you're using the New King James like I am, I wanted to translate the numbers here for size. And imagine now what this presence looked like. Goliath was 6 cubits and a span, which means he was over 9 feet tall. I don't know, how high is this ceiling? 9 feet? 8? 8. So his head is sticking through the ceiling, and he's standing right here. You got to understand the scale. And he was not skinny. He wasn't built like me. He was big and strong and muscular. Now notice, he had a bronze helmet on his head, armed with a coat of mail. The weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze, 125 pounds, the coat of mail. If I had 125 pounds on my shoulder, I'd be hard put to get it out the door. And he's just wearing that as his coat of mail. Bronze greaves on his legs, bronze javelin. The staff of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and iron spearhead weighed 15 pounds. I know what a 10-pound sack of potatoes feels like. You imagine taking a 15 pounds of potatoes, sticking it on the end of a stick, and then just holding that stick. Clunk. Just the tip of just the spearhead. And so what you have here is a monster of a man in size. Not just tall, but enormously strong, carrying incredible armament. I mean, this is like walking up to a tank with a pop gun and staring it down. I mean, it's that kind of a scale in terms of armaments here. And he stood and cried out the armies of Israel and said, "Why have you come out to line up for battle?" Am I not a Philistine and you the servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves. Let him come down to me. If he's able to fight with me and kill me, we will be your servants. If I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and serve us. And the Philistine said, I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together. Saul and the army obviously were very, very afraid because there was no one physically able to stand up to such a threat as that. David here comes along. Verse 19 mentions that Saul and all of the men of Israel were in the valley of Elah here, and David rose up early in the morning, left the sheep with the keeper, took the things and went as Jesse commanded him, and came to the camp as the army of Israel was going out to the fight to shout and shouting for the battle. So there's this yelling taking place back and forth, and the armies are lined up, but they haven't actually engaged. David left his supplies in the hand of a supply keeper, ran to the army, and came and greeted his brothers. And he talked with them, and there was the champion, the Philistine, Goliath, coming up from the army, and he spoke according to the same words, and David heard them. And all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled and were dreadfully afraid. And the men of Israel said, have you seen this man who's come up? Surely he has come to defy Israel. It shall be that the man who kills him, the king will enrich with great riches, give him his daughter, and give his father's house exemption in Israel. You know, David basically didn't care that much about what the prizes were. He talks about what will be done, but he says in verse 26, who is this uncircumcised Philistine? Not, you know, uncircumcised. You know what that meant? I mean, not technically what that meant. You know what that meant? It meant, who is someone not in covenant with God, because circumcision was the sign of the covenant with Abraham, who is someone without covenant with God who would defy the armies of Israel? Who is someone without God's protection and guidance to defy whom God has chosen in his service? It goes on in verse 32. David then said to Saul, let no man's heart fail because of him. Your servant will go and fight with the Philistine. And you go through the account, and Saul says, well, look, you can't do it. And David talks about the time that he saved a lamb out of the mouth of a lion or a bear, and how he had protected the flock and how God was with him. Verse 36, your servant has killed both lion and bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, seeing that he has defied the armies of the living God. Moreover, David said, the Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion, the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of the Philistine. And so Saul said, go, the Lord be with you. Verse 45, David goes out to confront Goliath. I mean, this is courage. This is not, I know how to shoot you down. This is raw-boned courage based on the fact that David served God and trusted God to use him and work through him, and that he had prepared as well by doing his part. David said to the Philistine, you come at me with a sword, spear, and a javelin. I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand. He didn't say, I'm going to beat you to a pulp. He said, this day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you and take your head from you. Absolute confidence here. Verse 48, going on down. I guess right before that says, the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hand. And it was so, when the Philistine arose, David came and drew near to meet David. And notice, David hastened and ran toward the army to meet the Philistine. He didn't just go out there kind of edging forward. He ran into battle. And so when you look at this and you see that David took out the sling and he killed Goliath and Goliath fell down dead, but you see the whole context. David did not doubt that God would be supreme. And God must have given him that courage and that knowledge that it was his will that this task be done. And when the time came to go into battle, he actually hastened and ran into the fight. Now that's just dramatic to me. It's remarkable an example like that, of that kind of courage. How many of us have actually run into a fight on God's behalf? Generally, our courage is expressed more quietly than that, is it not? Generally speaking, even under duress. Back in 1979, when the receivership was imposed on the Church of God there, Worldwide Church of God at that time in Pasadena, I was working in the Hall of Administration, and church members came in and camped in and took over the Hall of Administration, basically, to secure it. We had people sleeping in the hallways at night, sleeping bags, bedrolls, blankets, pillows, laying out, children, strollers. Mr. Blackwell, I remember, leading services constantly, just permanent church services were going. He was just reading through the Bible, teaching, expounding from Isaiah and some of the prophetic books and talking as we sat and listened. And they had SWAT teams that had been prepared if they needed to come in and take the building. They didn't want to do that because we were a church holding church services, and that didn't look very good, and newsmen and cameras are out there. But there was an occasion when the police lined up, and I don't know now, it's been so many years, if it was a SWAT team or a group of special forces, or I don't know what it was, but a group of policemen came up, and they had somebody with them, and they headed for the front door of the Hall of Administration, and we'd locked all the doors, and they'd have to literally break in to take the building. And I was standing down there on the bottom floor watching that, and I can assure you that when those policemen headed for the door, I did not go up to be the first in line. You know, I could stay there, and I could stay in the building, and I could watch what was happening, but I was reluctant. It was fearful to me to think about those policemen breaking down that front door and coming in and hauling us off to jail. I had visions at that time of my parents watching national news as I'm walking out. Hi, Mom. Hi, Dad. You know, don't worry. We're not doing anything wrong, you know. Once in a while, on occasion, I had some paperwork to take to legal offices down into Los Angeles, Mr. LaRavia gave me, and I found myself relieved, thinking, well, maybe they'll break in while I'm gone. I'm out getting a soda and a coffee and delivering these very important papers, but, you know, it was those times. The courage was there, and the many people who sat there fighting in their way as best we understood for what we believed, but it wasn't dramatic. It was very quiet. It was very much inside. We weren't running into battle. We were sitting there hoping battle never engaged, but we were standing there just the same. The courage that we live by day by day is probably not the kind of courage David had in facing Goliath. It's the kind of courage that Frank was talking about, frankly, in terms of overcoming our fears and standing and making the decisions that we need to make and obeying God in very quiet and maybe almost simple ways. Look at Luke 21. Now, here's an example of courage that's different. But it's the kind of courage that you and I work with on a more regular basis. Luke 21, verse number 1. He looked up and saw the rich putting their gifts into the treasury, and he saw also a certain poor widow putting in 2 mites. And he said, truly I say to you that this poor widow has put in more than all, for all these out of their abundance has put in offerings to God, but she out of her poverty has put in all the livelihood that she had. What took more courage? And it wasn't bold and brassy running out to face somebody with a spear. It was a widow very quietly and privately slipping a couple of coins into a box, giving in that instance all that she had. Now that's courage. Now what you're going to find is you go through this whole passage, Luke 21, and it begins to talk about the end time and circumstances and signs of the end time. And you're going to find that part of what is being addressed is not running up and charging the armies. It's the quiet courage of commitment, the courage of our convictions, the kind of courage the widow had, and that's why it's in this same basic context. I know the chapter breaks came out along later, but this is being written continuous, and there's relationship here to itself. Verse number 7. They asked him and said, "Teacher, when will these things be, and what sign will there be of these things that are about to take place?" And he said, "Take heed that you not be deceived, for many will come in my name, saying, 'I am he.' The time is drawn near, therefore do not go after them." And you begin to work down, and he talks about nation rising against nation, kingdom against kingdom, earthquakes, famines, pestilence, fearful sights. Last night, Megan and Derek and I, it was late, probably 10:30 to 11 o'clock, laid on a tramp in our backyard. We're just laying there looking at the sky. Dramatic to look up. The moon was bright and the clouds were coming through and you couldn't see much. And all we could see was this little band right above us, just a strip where there was a break in the clouds. And in a half hour, we watched 9 satellites zip through just that little strip. Now that's a wonder, but that's man's wonder. When God does wonders, you won't have to wonder whether you see them or not. It's going to be so dramatic and it's going to be frightening. I mean, looking up in the sky and seeing wonders in the heavens shaken, as it says, the powers of the heavens shaken in verse 26. It's going to be remarkable. There'll be great signs from heaven. You won't be straining through the clouds to see this little satellite go whizzing by. "But before these things, they'll lay their hands on you and persecute you, delivering you up to the synagogues and prisons, and you'll be brought before kings and rulers for my name's sake." Now, we're talking about the end time, and notice we're not talking about just a bunch of ne'er-do-wells here, a bunch of people who failed to obey God, who weren't committed. They're kind of Laodicean and lethargic and lazy and sloppy. They're just leftover Christians that were kind of tested after they were left behind. It doesn't give that indication at all. "But it will turn out for you as an occasion for testimony. Therefore, settle it in your hearts not to meditate beforehand on what you will answer. I'll give you a mouth." David wasn't worried about being the perfect shot as much as he was worried about serving the perfect God. The difference is dramatic. "I will give you a mouth and wisdom for which all your adversaries will not be able to contradict or to resist." Verse 17, "You'll be hated by all for my name's sake. Not a hair on your head will be lost." And then in verse 19, it ties back in to the widow's mite. "In your patience, possess your souls." It's talking about having trust and courage. Not worrying about what's going to happen, but looking to God. "And in your patience, because you're willing to wait, hold on, do what you know to do and to keep doing it even when threatened, to quietly go on and continue in service to God. In your patience, possess your souls." That's a dramatic courage in some ways, but it's very much inside and personal. It's a conviction because of our calling and service to God. Trusting God day by day in living this Christian life. Back in Psalm 131, there's a psalm that ties into this in terms of how we personally focus and build faith and look to God. Psalm 131. "Lord, my heart is not haughty, nor my eyes lofty." It's saying, I'm not looking here to myself. I'm not counting here on my own strength. "Neither do I concern myself with great matters, nor with things too profound for me. Surely I have calmed and quieted my soul, like a weaned child with his mother. Like a weaned child is my soul within me. O Israel, hope in the Lord from this time forth and forever." The point here is having that quiet confidence and courage in God. Not in ourselves, not in our might and power, not in lifting ourselves up, but in looking to God. "Surely I have calmed and quieted my soul," reduced ourselves. humbled ourselves before God. And that humility is actually peace. It's comfort. Frankly, before God, it's security. Many times when we face personal struggles, maybe in our families, possibly on our jobs, when we face illness, Mrs. Tower's funeral tomorrow is number 6 this year on this circuit, number 6. And many of those who died before they died went through a period of time of struggle or pain or distress or trauma or fear. And God knows that we face those kinds of things, not just because we're dying, mostly because we're living in this flesh. In the very deepest sense, when those things happen, we walk through that alone. Now, by alone, I don't mean we don't have friends, and I don't mean we don't have family or somebody holding our hand, but the fact is, the pain, the agony, the distress is something you have to settle in your own mind, and no one can take that away. Nobody can go through it for you. Nobody suffers in your place. You walk through that in your own mind, you and God. The family helps, the friends help, the church helps. We all want to contribute, but we walk through those things with ourselves and with God, and that takes courage. It takes a quiet kind of courage. When I left Mrs. Bose in the hospital, because it looked like she was strong enough to still last for a day or two, and I sat there with her the evening before she died the next morning, and I pondered in my mind, I don't want to leave her if she's going to die, but God doesn't tell us these wonderful things. How do we know? And so I thought, well, I was tired as well, and it had been a long couple of days there, and I just thought, well, I'll get a night's rest, and I'll come back in the morning, and I'll be here for tomorrow. And Grandma and Grandpa went down to be with her in the morning, and they were actually with her when she died. But, you know, I thought back of that. Mrs. Bose, until through that night, was alert. Now, maybe not in the morning, and so I don't know what point, but I was speaking to her. I was talking to her, and she was acknowledging that I was there. And a few hours earlier, I said, I need to go, and you could tell it. She didn't want to be alone, and she asked me to stay, and so I stayed. I stayed another few hours, and then finally, I just had to go. But I thought back, you know, she laid there by herself, her and God, in her discomfort, in her weakness, knowing that she was dying. And I wish I would have been there with her, but I wasn't. But even if I was there, still at some level, we walk through those things alone, in our hearts. And that takes courage. It takes courage to lie there and not thrash around. It takes courage to have the trust that God is in charge and that it will work out. It takes courage to not, it takes courage, frankly, not to become bitter or angry or frustrated in our constraints. When a river flows through a channel that tightens up, it boils and surges and rises up because it's constrained. And yet we're not like a river. And God says there are times when we're going to flow through a tightened circumstance. And with our courage and conviction and trust in God, God literally would have us to flow through those times quietly, comfortably, in trust and in faith. David ran to meet Goliath because he was confident, the confidence God gave him, that God was absolutely on his side. There was no doubt in his mind. There could not have been. I read a scripture recently, Psalm 4, verse 8, where it says, I will both lie down in peace and sleep. For you alone, O Lord, make me to dwell in safety. You alone. Not the power of my hand, not my family or my friends, not my means, my bank account, my car, my opportunities, my job. You alone make me to dwell in safety. Absolute trust in God is where that kind of quiet courage, which gives us peace, where that comes from. Larry Grider is the director of the United Youth Camps, and he was at Challenger Camp, and he gave a compass check at the beginning of the camp, and he entitled it Reaching Deep. And the point of his compass check, and a compass check is like a 15-minute sermonette, basically, at the start of each day, and that's supposed to point us in the direction that we focus on for the day in our classes and all of our activities. It was about being strong physically, mentally, and spiritually. And in that context, he spoke about courage. He said, some people will go out and hang on a cliff. And he was describing these shelters that some will climb in like a big wall. They'll get partway up, and they have this little platform that they hang from three or four different straps off of that cliff face, and they lay inside this little cramped shelter and exist. And sometimes when a storm moves in, they lay in there for days, waiting for the weather to pass before they can continue their ascent. And he said some men go out like that, or women, that people go hang on a cliff. They'll do other incredibly challenging things. He said in conditions that are worse than most of our prisons. And what do they call it? They call it adventure. He said, yet sometimes in the church we have discomfort and challenge, and what do we call it? We call it a trial. And he says, you know, it's interesting. Some people endure much, and they call it adventure, and sometimes when we have to endure a little, we call it a trial. In part, it's just a matter of perspective. He referred, and he had the Time magazine, where on the cover was a picture of Eric Weinmayer, I think is how his name might be pronounced. He's blind, and he summited Everest on the 25th of May. You know, I pulled him up on the internet and I was reading some of the accounts. When he climbed McKinley, he's climbed four of the seven highest peaks, at least the highest peak on each continent in the world. He's climbed now, I think five if you count Everest. He's climbed all but two. And it described when he had climbed Mount McKinley and how the final ascent for McKinley, the last quarter mile up on the trail, is a ridge. And on one side of the ridge, it drops off 9,000 feet. And on the other side of the ridge, it only drops off 1,000 feet. And you have this narrow edge you walk up on the final ascent to the top. And he's blind. So you can't make any mistakes. And he feels with a stick, and he steps in other people's steps, and he has a balance. He can feel the snow under his feet. He's developed the sense for that. And he was climbing up that, and he did fine. He's climbed the face of Yosemite called the Nose, one of the classic 3,000-foot climbs in the world, blind. He passed one climber going up, and the guy called over to him, and he talked back, and the guy had no idea that he was just being passed by somebody who was blind going up the face of it. I mean, he can feel the cracks, and he's incredibly strong, and he trains. And I pulled an account from a Sports Illustrated article that was before he finished it, and it mentions that he's climbed Mount McKinley in Alaska, Mount Aconcagua in Argentina, Mount Vincent in Antarctica, and Mount Kilimanjaro in Tanzania, and then Everest he conquered in May of this year. He says little about the 32-year-old Weinmayer connects with traditional stereotypes of the blind. At Weston High, he was Connecticut's second-ranked wrestler in his weight class. Connecticut in the state. He runs marathons. He's made nearly 50 solo skydives. Now, I don't know how you do that. I've parachuted. I injured myself. Took almost 2.5, 3 years to heal one time because I tried to stand up on a military chute. And they're not supposed to stand up, and I'm going to be real brave. So I stood up, and I just literally pile-drived myself into the ground. took me about 3 years to heal. It's when he's perched on the side of a mountain that he feels most alive. I like the spiritual feeling of being on a mountain, he says, the space, the sounds, the vast openness of it. The most annoying question I get is, why climb when you can't see the view from the top? He says, you don't climb for the view. You can go up an elevator for the view. You can fly in a plane. You don't climb for the view. No one suffers the way you do on a mountain for a beautiful view. The real beauty of life happens on the side of the mountain, not the top. And I thought, that is incredible. What a perspective. It's life. It's the process of life. It's not getting it over with, finishing it, and reaching the end. He's quoted here in the 1920s when asked, why do you want to climb Mount Everest? And George Mallory asserted, because it's there. He was only stating the less important half of the question. The unspoken half is that we are here. It's what we do, not because of what it is. It's what's in our heart. Striving and achieving is part of our nature. He says it's built into our genetic makeup. Now, when God gives us His Spirit, do you not think that striving to attain is not part of what that Spirit then pulls and yearns to draw us to do? Of course it is, because God wants us to be like Him. And so He grants us the capacity to exercise courage so that we will obey Him, follow Him, trust Him, so that we will keep the Sabbath, so that we will tithe, so that we will come to church even when it's not fun or pleasant. Because the church is a body, it's a congregation, it's an assembly. So that we will marry and remain committed in that relationship. So that we will raise our children even when it's painful. So that we will love when we are not being loved in return. Frank talked about agape love. Seeking the good of the other no matter what. Loving your enemy is not because your enemy is your friend. If he was your friend, he wouldn't be your enemy. But God says, love your enemy. It's going the other way. It's sacrificing ourselves so our children have opportunity. Something people used to do and now is a much more narrow commodity in this society. Bumper stickers, I'm spending my inheritance in advance. Or I'm spending my children's inheritance, or that's how I got this car, or various things. Turning the other cheek takes courage. Being offended and not becoming bitter takes courage. Trusting God when you're lonely or when you're afraid. Going to the feast when your job is at risk. Being content when you're going without. Starting over when you fail. Being forgiving when you've been wronged, loving when you've been hurt. All take courage. Not the kind of courage that David had charging across the field to engage Goliath. No, it takes a quiet courage and conviction that's deep down inside. Something that we need to live with in order to follow God and respond to His calling day by day. That kind of quiet courage is walking away from this world's ways and putting God first. At the end of Mr. Grider's compass check, he told a kind of a parable as a story with a lesson attached to it. This is part of what you stole in my conclusion, Frank. Just wanted to know we're going to end, at least in relationship, in the same place, although he managed to steal it before he even got to his conclusion. He said there was an old wise Indian chief. I thought about making this politically correct and just making it an old wise white man, and that would be politically correct, but I'll tell it the way he told it. There was an old wise Indian chief, and there was a disrespectful young brave that wanted to test him. And the young brave reached down and picked up a little bird in his hand and put it behind his back and walks up to the chief. And he says, "Oh, wise chief, what is it I have in my hand?" And the chief had seen what he had done, and so he just turned and said, "Well, in your hand you have a bird." And the brave thought, well, I will best him yet. I will ask him if it's dead or alive, and if he says it's alive, then I will crush it and drop it to the ground at his feet. And if he says if it's dead, I will release it in front of his face and shame him. And so the brave says, O wise chief, is it dead or alive? And the chief looked him in the eye and said, it is as you choose. Looking to God, trusting in God, is a choice. Courage, whether quiet or bold, is a choice as well. It is as we choose. God called us and we answered. He gives us strength and we draw on that and we follow Him. But the courage we exercise, or the courage we fail to exercise, brethren, in this life is as we choose. It's up to us.